At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Somebody told me not too long ago that the U.S. economy is the best-looking horse in the glue factory. So, we got that going for us. The global economy, as we get going today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Khan Rizdal. It is Wednesday, the 8th day of October. Great to have you with us, as always. I don't want to get all highfalutin on you here, but there was a concept in international economics that was real, real hot 5 or 6 years ago, just as things in the United States were going south. Decoupling was the buzzword. The idea that the world's emerging economies no longer needed us. They were doing great, we weren't, and that was going to be the new state of things. Fast forward to today, and the International Monetary Fund says, yeah, not so fast. In its latest review of global growth prospects, the IMF says we, that is the United States, are due for 3% growth, plus or minus, next year. Europe and China, substantially less. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour connects the economic dots.
Compared to many other countries, the U.S. is doing great. Emphasis on compared to.
The U.S. is the one-eyed man in the country of the blind.
Jacob Kierkegaard is senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. 2% growth this year is nothing to brag about, but still.
The U.S. is the only one that seems to be turning in the other direction.
The rising dollar means we can buy more of other countries' goods, which will help some parts of the global economy. On the other hand,
there is a challenge that comes from a U.S. recovery.
Stephen Kaplan is assistant professor of international affairs at George Washington University. When the U.S. was in crisis, investors shifted money to developing economies. Now that the U.S. is back on its feet, the reverse is happening.
It might be more difficult for governments and firms abroad to borrow in an environment where more capital is going to be dedicated to the United States.
Another problem, though the U.S. is pulling ahead, Europe is not.
Europe not growing at all or very slowly is not good for anybody in the world.
Matthew Slaughter teaches at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. Europe altogether has the largest economy in the world. A weak Europe is less likely to import from the U.S. or China, which is slowing down. And Slaughter says its problems, like an 11.5% unemployment rate, run deep.
Even before the crisis, they were already in this no growth in population, slow productivity growth environment.
The IMF says Europe has a 38% chance of slipping into a recession again, double the odds in April. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
We'll go right ahead and continue with the theme of the day now, the idea of connecting economic dots with unemployment. The jobless rate is now comparatively low, 5.9% as of the last reading last Friday. Job openings are now at a 13-year high. So too, though, is the amount of time it is taking companies to find somebody to fill their empty jobs, almost one full calendar month. Sally Herships explains that disconnect.
Jobs are out there, so why is it taking employers so long to fill them?
Well, I think the key reason is that there is a mismatch in the jobs market going on.
Robert Johnson is director of economic analysis at Morningstar. He says the job vacancy situation is like plaid on top of polka dots. There is a lot going on. First, while there are jobs, some may be part-time and workers may be holding out for the real deal, full-time. Next, some industries may be looking for skilled workers who don't exist. Kristen Ripmaster works with ConstructionJobs.com.
There definitely is a shortage in the labor market right now. Everybody's experiencing it in construction.
Ripmaster says construction took a hit during the downturn, and a lot of the young people who chose to go into the industry stopped. Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He has another take on the mismatch.
It doesn't seem that skills are the issue.
Baker says the biggest disconnect between available jobs and how long it takes to fill them is in the retail and restaurant industries.
It's a little hard to believe that the reason that restaurants and retail stores have all these openings that are going unfilled is because they can't find qualified workers.
Baker says if employers need workers, they'll have to begin offering higher salaries. And Dice Holdings, a company that tracks how long it takes to fill jobs, says both employers and workers have been getting pickier about what they want, which makes it harder to find a match. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Traders took a look at the minutes of the last Federal Reserve meeting that were released today and bought, confident in the knowledge Dr. Yellen et al. Will continue to backstop the economy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You can talk economic dot connecting until the cows come home, but at some point all the theory becomes real life. How much stuff costs, how easy or hard it is to get a job, and what is actually going on out there. Lisa Goldenberg is the president of the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania. We call her up when we need answers to some of those real life questions. Lisa, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to speak with you as well. It's wonderful to catch up.
So I'll tell you what, I went back and I checked the tape from the last time you and I spoke in July of this year. You said you weren't doing as well as you would have hoped this time of year. How you doing now, what, 4 months later?
Well, I would have to say that it's about the same. We should have had a stronger September based on all numbers and indication. We're doing okay, but okay isn't good enough. It's a struggle.
Well, so what gives? I mean, the economy's growing at 4-something percent a year, right? Are you not seeing that?
Well, yeah, but 4% is an overall aggregate number. In
yes.
the moment, our sectors are very strong. By us, apartment housing is really growing in Pennsylvania. For the steel business, that's a good thing. Construction is good. People go out and they need washers and dryers and all kinds of things made out of steel. But it takes a long time to get through the economy. So we're standing back 4 months. Are they better than July? No, they're not better than July. Are they better than last July or last September? Sure.
Yeah, spitball it for me then and talk to me about March of 2015. What are you looking at?
Well, I think we're going to continue to be better, but it's incremental. The bad news is it's painful to live through slow, even, deliberate growth. It's painful.
Right.
On the other hand, it is the best way, in my opinion, to build a solid economy.
Do you go down to the lunchroom every now and then and just chit-chat with people?
It's funny because right before you and I spoke, that's exactly where I was.
Yeah. What were the conversations? What are people talking about?
People have a few more bucks in their pocket than they did a year ago. The few extra bucks to give your kids, the few extra bucks to spend at the store. All those things are definitely better. On the other hand, they're not relieved of this giant burden of debt.
Are you able to hire? Are you able to increase wages at all?
Can't increase wages at all. Really holding bonuses and increases. CPI is even a struggle.
Wow, really? Even though there's basically no inflation in this economy, it's tough for you to match that.
Sure, because things are really competitive. So margins are getting squeezed all over the place. So the middle guy is absorbing a lot of that margin and unable to pass it along to manufacturing.
And that's you. You're the middle guy.
I'm the middle guy.
Lisa Goldenberg. She is the president of Delaware Steel of Pennsylvania. Lisa, thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Pleasure. Thank you so much.
We've been asking you that same basic set of real-life economic questions. We trimmed it down a little bit to how is your economy doing? Here's Kathy Dominick. She lives in Sacramento, California.
I was a senior professional geologist for about 20 years. I lost that job in 2012, and I'm in a stall. I've been living off my savings for 2 years, but I'm fearful that what is in there now is all I will ever have to my name. I'm actually going to be changing careers. I'm going to be a pastry chef in a restaurant. It never occurred to me that I would become a professional baker, ever. It's going to be a lot different. I know a lot of people who are restaurant professionals who don't really have any savings. So I guess the habits of the last 2 years will serve me well. But if the restaurant does really well, we hope to open a second location, and hopefully that prosperity will be shared with me as well. I'm an optimist, and maybe sometimes my optimism is a little bit overreaching, but for Americans, we're optimists.
Kathy Dominick out of Sacramento, California. Take a minute, and seriously, I mean just a minute here. Let us know how your economy is doing. There's a spot on our homepage where you can tell us. It is marketplace.org. The news out of Dallas this morning that Ebola patient Thomas Eric Duncan has died, and reports of another possible, and let me say that again, possible case in Dallas, underscores the stakes around controlling the spread of that disease. To that point, the White House announced today that airline passengers arriving from West Africa at five big U.S. airports would be screened to see if they're running fevers, one of the telltale signs of that disease. Separately, the CDC says it has 1,000 people working around the world to contain that disease. It's on-the-ground work that involves a lot of risk, a lot of problem-solving, and increasingly, some money management. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports from the Health Desk at WHYY.
It takes something special to sign up for the CDC's Epidemic Intelligence Service. Dr. Bridget Gleason, who turned 30 this week, says she's seen tragedy every day since September 13th, the moment she arrived in Sierra Leone.
Being surrounded by death, it's obviously overwhelming if you really focus on that.
But Gleason says she hasn't focused on death.
To really make a difference, you just have to focus on what you can do.
That attitude gives a sense of the men and women who parachute into these communicable disease hotspots. Every year, the CDC hires 70 to 80 EIS officers, often medical doctors with public health backgrounds, for the two-year program. What you do as a disease detective varies. Some years it's what you may expect, tracking mosquitoes that carry West Nile virus. But this year, CDC frontline epidemiologists like Peter Kilmarks in Sierra Leone must do something outside the norm, even for them. Think about budgets.
We're not fully meeting the demand, and it's stressful. It's a very challenging situation.
For the past 20 years, CDC field staff has depended on the nonprofit CDC Foundation for money when it would otherwise take too long to go through bureaucratic channels at the agency. But the outbreak has gotten so big, so fast, that's changed.
There is simply not enough money at this time to meet the needs that CDC is sending our way.
Foundation Executive Director Charlie Stokes understands putting a crimp in this financial lifeline is actually a matter of life and death. That's why the foundation launched an emergency fund back in August to address Ebola.
We initially thought $30 million would be enough. What we're seeing in terms of needs in the field tells me it's going to be considerably more than that.
To put that figure in perspective, that's what the foundation spends on all of its programs in a year. Stokes estimates Ebola needs $50 million alone. If the foundation falls short, Stokes knows he'll have to level with the CDC docs.
We're either going to have the money and send it, or we're going to have to say you're going to have to prioritize.
Stokes admits it's easy to feel overmatched by this epidemic, but much like Dr. Bridget Gleason in Sierra Leone, he says he's going to focus on what he can do. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up,
AAA just released a report this week saying that voice command software is actually not working out very well.
Yeah, that to the list of things standing between me and my driverless car, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. My, oh my, the Dow Industrial is up 274 points today, 1.6%, closed at 16,994, biggest day of 2014, by the by. The NASDAQ bumped up 83 points, 1.9%, finished at 4,468. The S&P 500 up 33 points, about 1.75%, ended things at 1968. The Gap is getting a new boss. The clothing retailer says Glenn Murphy will step down as chairman and CEO in February. Executive Art Peck will become the new boss. Shares down 8% in aftermarket trading. Welcome to the company, Art. Struggling retailer JCPenney. It's always struggling retailer JCPenney, isn't it? JCPenney cut its sales forecast for their current quarter. Shares took a dive down more than 10% today. Bonds up. Yields down 2.31%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales for August. We also get a look at retail data. Chain stores are scheduled to report September sales. And Batman goes postal. The USPS issues new forever stamps featuring the Dark Knight, protecting Gotham City and your love letters from villains. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Branding, as we have said, I don't know how many times on this program, is everything. And right near the top of the list of industries with branding problems is fracking, not the least of the problems being the word itself, short for hydraulic fracturing, and uncomfortably close in sound to a word I am not allowed to say on the radio. Anti-fracking activists have long exploited that closeness, but an industry group is trying to reclaim the word in Pennsylvania, which is an especially hot fracking battleground. Marketplace's Dan Wiseman has the story.
Here's the punchline to a 30-second ad touting fracking's contribution to jobs and lower energy costs in Pennsylvania.
Fracking's a good word.
Fracking's a good word. Fracking rocks.
It started running in late September, sponsored by the Marcellus Shale Coalition, and it's part of a larger campaign called Rock Solid for PA. Get it? Fracturing? Rocks? David Spiegelmeyer is the group's president.
Some people will try to use that word in a negative connotation. All we're doing is trying to shine a light on the fact that, you know, there's a lot of good that comes out of the use of that technology. That's all.
David Macer is director of Penn Environment, a nonprofit that opposes fracking. He's noticed the ads.
Yes, it's been highly entertaining.
He thinks it means he and his allies are winning in a court of public opinion.
There's something funny when, you know, companies like ExxonMobil and Shell and Halliburton and BP are saying, man, we're just getting creamed by the local nonprofit group.
But maybe it could work. It did for Obamacare. Tim Calkins teaches marketing at Northwestern University. He's the author of Defending Your Brand.
Obamacare is very interesting because it did start out as sort of an attack on the program, and yet now supporters of it use it just like everyone else. In a way, it's actually very smart.
However, Obamacare had a charismatic, witty spokesman who could get on TV whenever he wanted. Fracking doesn't have that yet.
You've got to get in front of people if you're going to reshape a brand.
For fracking, that would mean a much bigger campaign. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Forget oil and gold and all the other pricey commodities you can think of. Let's talk water for a minute here. It is amazingly cheap, one of the cheapest things you can buy right now. We're conserving the heck out of it here in California and most of the West, or trying to, I should say, because of the drought. Same thing, though, is happening in lots of the rest of the country, not only because saving water is the right thing to do, but also because appliances are way more efficient than they used to be. Funny thing is that in some places, no matter how much water you save, your water bills are still going up. Kate Davidson reports.
They say in life, a few things are certain. Death, taxes, and I'd add one more. Going potty. But these days, it takes a lot less water to flush than it used to.
We're in the toilet aisle.
Sean Jones is showing me around the Home Depot in Gaithersburg, Maryland.
We're looking at a couple of models here, American Standard, Glacier, and we have Polar.
20 toilets in a gleaming row. When all of them flush, they flush low flow. Toilets once used 5 to 7 gallons of water per flush. And now?
1.28 gallons of water flushes per flush.
Yes.
Per flush. I'm trying to say it in technical terms, but in terms of using the bathroom, 1.28.
And it's not just toilets. Decades of federal standards have created a new normal. Water-efficient dishwashers, shower heads, and washing machines that save thousands of gallons a year. Water and wastewater utilities have also urged conservation, including the Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission, or WSSC, here in Maryland.
So we've had a 30-plus year message of conserve, conserve, conserve.
So that's just what West Laurel resident Melissa Dastin did.
I've replaced all of my toilets to low-flow toilets. I save up all my dishes until I have a full load. I have stopped watering my lawn years and years and years ago.
But if Dastin's water use has fallen, her water rates have not. She's not complaining about it, but she's noticed.
They've gone up. Point blank, they've gone up year after year after year after year.
Chris Cullinan is WSSC's acting CFO. I meet him at one of the utility's water filtration plants. He says WSSC is producing less water than it did 20 years ago, even though it's added more than 70,000 customer accounts. Because of fixed costs, the less water people use, the more these public utilities have to charge for it.
We make money when we sell water. That's our primary revenue source. And so while from an environmental standpoint, conservation is certainly one of our objectives, from a business standpoint, it certainly presents some challenges.
The biggest challenge is aging infrastructure. WSSC has about 5,600 miles of water pipes and almost as many sewer pipes. 5,600 miles is a lot.
It's from New York to L.A. and back within a service area encompassing two counties.
The utility is also under a court order to fix sewer overflows, which Cullinan says will cost more than $1 billion. He says costs like these have driven water rates up 95% over the last 10 years. David LaFrance is CEO of the American Water Works Association. He says buried infrastructure is a big financial problem for utilities across the country.
Those pipes were put into ground anywhere from 70 to 100 years ago. There's massive needs for replacements. We estimate that over the next 25 years, it's a $1 trillion problem.
And the solution won't all come in the form of rate hikes. Like other utilities, WSSC wants to stabilize its rate increases by charging higher fees, a move which the smallest users could feel disproportionately. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Most of the time, I know what the interviews I'm about to do are all about. Sometimes I really don't, and this is one of those. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. He is with us every couple of weeks for a segment called Codebreaker, what technology means in our actual lives. And here we go. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so what do you got, man?
All right, I got a movie clip for you. I want to play you a little movie clip to give you a hint about what we're going to talk about.
Okay.
Hello. I'm Johnny Cash.
What is it? Okay.
Drive. Drive!
Would you please repeat the destination?
Oh, anywhere, just go! Go!
Please state a street and number.
Okay, all right.
Can you recognize the actor in there?
Not even for a second, no.
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Arnold, okay.
This is Arnold, and this is from the movie Total Recall.
Total Recall, yeah,
original
okay.
movie.
Yeah, yeah.
It's when he's getting in a cab, and the cab is, Kai,
yes.
a self-driving
car. Oh, self-driving,
car.
Yes. Yes, it is. All right, so we're talking about self-driving cars?
Yeah, and we're going to talk about how far away we are.
Really?
From self-driving cars. Yeah,
don't we have self-driving cars? Google's got them like all over Silicon Valley, or like a dozen of them.
Well, they've got a couple of them. They've been testing them, and they're very, very excited about them. But we're actually a pretty long ways away. There's a couple reasons for this. First of all, let's talk about cost,
okay.
right? How much do you think a self-driving car might cost, one of the Google ones?
One of those Prius things?
Yeah, yeah.
$87,543 and 27 cents.
That's a very specific
it
and
is.
Excellent guess,
Kai. I am a specific kind of guy.
But $320,000
really?
Is the estimate for the cost of that car.
Who's got that kind of money?
Nobody right now, yeah. right? Your average American family can apparently afford to spend maybe about $20,000 yeah. on a car. So yeah. cost is a problem.
Okay.
Also, software. GPS systems get scrambled when you go through a tunnel sometimes, if you're under tree cover. Software has struggled to deal with some of the more subtle or layered pedestrian stuff, too. Think about a stoplight going out or a truck jumping a curb. Software is, like, really good at dealing with stuff that it's been designed to deal with. It's way harder for you to design software to deal with data that it hasn't predicted yet.
All right. What about two things? One is the speed at which technology tends to advance, right? I mean, the fallback
yes.
is Moore's law, but, you know, I mean, cell phone adoption, right? 10 years ago, who had a cell phone and was staring at them all the time? And now we all do. And the other thing to think about, though, and honestly, I'm a little surprised, Ben, you didn't think about this. As more people throw money at self-driving cars will become more widely adopted because they'll become cheaper and the technology will get better.
I think that that's a fair point. But, Kai, once again, I think no matter how much money you're spending on this, you still really have to deal with incremental changes. Now, cell phones may be new, but phones are not, right?
Yes, that's true.
So think about the sort of vast majority of technological history. We've got some massive leaps forward, but in between, there's a bunch of incremental steps. And the incremental steps so far – They're kind of giving us a bumpy ride, Kai. AAA just released a report this week saying that voice command software is actually not working out very well in cars and becoming more distracting, or as distracting as actually poking at your smartphone. So even our baby steps need to take baby steps, you know?
And bumpy ride. That was pretty good. Do we, though, necessarily want self-driving cars? I mean, I actually like to drive, you know, my minivan and all that.
I know. And I'm with you, man. I think that this is actually perhaps an even bigger cultural question for us. This software takes a long time to perfect. It takes a long time for humans to get used to this idea. And I just don't think it's going to happen for another couple decades. I hate to tell you.
All right. I think you're wrong. But, you know, I'll call you up in 20 years and we'll figure it out.
All right. Sounds good. I'll drive over in my manual car.
Me, I'm taking my jetpack, yo. Ben Johnson, he's the host of Marketplace Tech. Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Guy.
This final note on the way out. October is, as you may know if you watched an NFL game this past weekend, Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Pink whistles, pink cleats, pink everything, practically. Also, now, this, which we saw in Salon today, courtesy of the oilfield services company Baker Hughes, 1,000 pink drill bits, which is great, I guess. But doesn't the pink get scraped off when the drills start drilling? And also, aren't there all kinds of carcinogens in oil, right? All right, we're done. That is the show for today. Whiz bang day on Wall Street. That's all I've got time for because we got to go. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.